I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, our conversation with a former college president who says lower the drinking age. It will actually save lives. He's taking a controversial stand, and we'll hear more. But first, Germans are asking a lot of questions today as three alleged Islamic militants appeared in court charged with plotting what the authorities described as imminent and massive bomb attacks on U.S.-related targets in Germany. German police today announced the arrests and say they confiscated 1,500 pounds of hydrogen peroxide, which, when combined with other substances, would have made bombs more powerful than the ones used in the terror attacks in Madrid and London. The apparent motive is hatred of Americans, is how the head of the German police put it. Mark Landler is Frankfurt bureau chief for the New York Times. He joins us now. And Mark, did we learn more after today's court appearance?
The details about their identities is, of course, closely guarded. We know that two of them are German nationals who've converted to Islam, and the third is a Turk who has permanent residency in Germany. We also learned that there may be as many as five other people under investigation in the plot. So we're talking about a plot that could have as many as eight people involved in it.
What, if any, groups did the three suspects belong to? And we understand that there had been warnings about Germans training in Pakistan training camps. Is there anything known about whether or not these suspects traveled abroad?
Well, yes. In fact, the German federal prosecutor said today that all three suspects had traveled to Pakistan and had taken part in terrorist training camps. This was exactly the threat that the German officials were warning of back in June when they spoke of a heightened risk of terrorism in Germany. I think what is a surprise is, number one, the scale of explosive material that these three men had apparently amassed. And secondly, and this part is a little less well established at this early stage, is the fact that there appears to be a significant Turkish involvement in the plot. One of the three arrested suspects is from Turkey, and it's possible that others among the people under investigation are too. Germany has historically worried about the possibility that its large or elements of its large Turkish minority would become radicalized, and if this plot is strong evidence that that has happened, then that would be a very worrisome thing for Germany.
Tell us more why.
Well, because the largest immigrant population in Germany is Turkish, with close to 3 million people. And unlike, notably, the Pakistanis in the United Kingdom, Turks have tended to shy away from radical Islamic causes and tended to have less of a role in terrorist organizations. And this is held up as one of the reasons that Germany has so far avoided the terrorism that has afflicted the United Kingdom.
Well, these arrests today come on the heels of the arrests yesterday of eight Islamic militants in Denmark. They allegedly had links to Al-Qaeda. What are the links, if any, of the suspects today?
German officials have said that they believe or suspect there may be links to Al-Qaeda. As to the Danish situation, the German officials today said that they weren't convinced there was any direct connection between those arrests and these arrests today. And indeed, it's worth noting that several of the people arrested in Denmark yesterday have been released. The group that the German officials say these men belong to is called Islamic Jihad Union, and it's an offshoot of something called the Islamic Movement for Uzbekistan, which is, the name implies, an Uzbek-based extremist group that has taken root elsewhere in Central Asia, including Pakistan, where these men were apparently recruited and trained and then dispatched back to Germany. So there's a lot we don't know, but it bears the hallmark of some of the ways that Al-Qaeda-inspired groups have operated in the past. Where I do think there's going to be soul-searching is in the types of anti-terrorism measures that the German law enforcement authorities use. Germany, for all sorts of reasons having to do with its World War II history, has had an aversion to using very tough, draconian anti-terror measures. Something like the Patriot Act would never fly in Germany. Now, in the wake of this, there promises to be a stronger debate about whether Germany needs to be more hardline in going after terrorists. this debate's already been underway in Germany. Indeed, in some ways, it's been underway since 2001, when Germany was stunned to find out that the 9/11 plot was actually hatched by militants in Hamburg. But I think it will give the debate some renewed urgency as Germany realizes that it's not just a seeding ground for terrorism, it may also be a target for terrorism.
New York Times Frankfurt Bureau Chief Mark Landler speaking to us from Germany. Mark, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
As the new school year starts, there is one certainty. Colleges will be confronting drinking issues. Already some schools, including Framingham State here in Massachusetts, are scheduling more classes on Fridays to try to blunt the trend of starting the weekend and the weekend drinking on Thursday nights. At the same time, the debate over lowering the drinking age from 21 to 18 is heating up. The proposal has been studied in a handful of states, and supporters are pushing a ballot initiative in Missouri. Now, there are some exceptions that allow 18-year-olds to drink, say, with parents in a restaurant in some states. But national transportation officials and groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving are fighting the effort to lower the age because they say thousands of lives have been saved by the higher age. One of the leading proponents of a lower drinking age is John McCardle. He's the former president of Middlebury College in Vermont and now president emeritus at the school. He formed an organization called Choose Responsibility to push this issue. He says lowering the drinking age would bring drinking out of fraternity basements and allow colleges to focus on teaching kids how to drink responsibly instead of policing underage drinking. It's a controversial suggestion. In fact, when we first aired our conversation with McCardle, we were flooded with your mail, pro and con. So we want to reprise it today. When we spoke last April, the issue was in the news because Rider University in New Jersey was dealing with the alcohol poisoning death of an 18-year-old freshman. That student died after excessive drinking during a fraternity pledge initiation, a ritual that McCardle then admitted might not have been prevented by a lower drinking age.
Much as we would like to see traffic fatalities reduced to zero and alcohol-related fatalities overall reduced to zero, we know better, given the imperfect world we live in, than to expect that as a realistic outcome. I think we need to ask ourselves several questions when we hear news reports like this. The first is this evidence that legal age 21 is working? And secondly, why ought we to think that lives lost on the highways are any more precious than lives lost to overconsumption of alcohol that, because of this law, has been forced into darkened corners, underground, and off campus?
Well, let's take a second to remind ourselves of the history here, especially when you say lives lost on the highway versus in dorm rooms. Back in the 70s, groups like MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, connected drunk driving accidents with underage drinking. Then, under pressure from MAD, Congress raised the national drinking age to 21 in 1984. And today, groups like MAD point to the fact that there have been fewer highway fatalities since then as a reason to keep the drinking age at 21. You say what?
I say Mothers Against Drunk Driving deserves a great deal of praise for educating the public over the last 20 years or so about the risks of drinking and driving. And I think to them accrues a great deal of credit for the fact that alcohol-related traffic fatalities have declined in every age group. Now, the fact that they've gone down in the over 40, over 50, over 60 group, it seems to me, is hard to ascribe to the 21-year-old drinking age. Furthermore, those fatalities were going down even before the law was passed. Secondly, they remain highest at age 21, followed by age 22, followed by age 23.
Well, you and your group point to other factors that might be taken into consideration, airbag, seatbelt usage.
The same statistics that tell us about lives saved because of legal age 21 demonstrate more lives have been saved by safety restraints in the last 2 years than have been saved by legal age 21 in the last 22 years. In 2002, 75% of those involved in alcohol-related traffic fatalities were not wearing a seatbelt. Seems to me that we need to take those kinds of data into account as well.
Well, and as you say, one of the effects of the law is that it's driven drinking underground. How would, making an 18-year-old legal change things?
I think we need to look at the environment that existed not just on college campuses, but everywhere in the country in the years prior to 1984. No, of course it wasn't perfect. Yes, of course there were instances where students drank more than they should. But the fact is that alcohol consumption was out in the open. That allowed institutions to monitor it, to manage it, to educate about it. It allowed the social scenes to be downtown and out in the open. It permitted intergenerational social interaction between adults. I think the most unfortunate aspect of this law is the fact that it has effectively disenfranchised and marginalized parents. Parents are placed in an impossible dilemma now of either looking the other way and condoning violation of the law by serving their children at home, or by strictly enforcing the law in their households and simply uprooting and transplanting the problem somewhere else.
Yeah, you're saying that when a kid has two beers with a pizza with some friends downtown, legally, he'll stop at two beers, whereas if he's up in his room with some six-packs with some friends hiding, he's actually going to drink more.
Not only that, the time and resources we are devoting to enforcing this law is distracting law enforcement from spending its time dealing with the very serious problems of alcohol and drunken driving on the highways. I think it's interesting to look at what happened when the speed limits were changed in the late 80s. Everyone predicted that when the states would be allowed to set the limits, accidents would go up and carnage would ensue. In fact, exactly the opposite happened, and after the law was changed and after the speed limits went up, we heard from law enforcement saying that at long last they can now redirect their energies to picking up people who are genuinely menaces on the road and not have to waste their time picking up people doing 65 in a 55-mile-an-hour zone. That's a very good analogy to where we are with the drinking age today.
Well, you've got supporters and critics. Let's start with some of the critics. Henry Wexler of Harvard School of Public Health Alcohol Study thinks your idea is a poor one. He says 19-year-olds don't drink responsibly, period. If it were publicly and legal, it would be just as irresponsible. They don't have two beers when they drink a lot. And that lowering the age of drinking would lower the age of kids trying it illegally.
How does he know? We've gotten several recent reports telling us, A, that binge drinking is worse than it's ever been, and B, that underage drinking is worse than it's ever been, and that the age at which a young person may first sample alcohol is younger than it's ever been. That doesn't seem to me proof that the existing law is working very well. Our proposal, in fact, is for education and licensing, and it would contain a provision that anyone who violates the alcohol laws of their state before turning 18 would forfeit eligibility for the license. We think that creating such an incentive may have more to do with addressing the problem of underage drinking than staring into space and believing naively that the current law is working.
In fact, you say teenagers should get drinking licenses just the way they get driving licenses. They take a course in alcohol responsibility?
We don't have a problem with underage driving, the last time I checked. And driver's ed works because there's a partnership between the family, the school, and the state, and there's the incentive in the form of a license at the end. It works, and I think alcohol education could be modeled on it.
John McArdle, former president of Middlebury College, and many college presidents agree with him, but in a Gallup poll released this summer, 77% of Americans were against a lower drinking age. So we'll have more with John later, the newest HBO series, back in a minute, here and now. We're back with our conversation on the drinking age with John McArdle. He was president of Middlebury College in Vermont for 13 years. He's formed an organization called Choose Responsibility with the provocative goal of pushing to have the drinking age lowered from 21 to 18. Groups such as Mothers Against Drunk Driving oppose the effort because they say thousands of lives have been saved since the drinking age was set at 21 in 1984. We first spoke with John McArdle in April, and with the new school year starting and colleges again dealing with the problem of underage drinking, we're revisiting that earlier conversation today. Professor McArdle, as we said, president of Middlebury for 13 years, I have to make a disclosure. I happen to know that many of your underage students used to go to Lyons Market right there off campus because my cousins owned the market, and in fact, they had to give it up because they couldn't afford the incredible liability of underage drinkers and with false IDs. What did you see on campus? What's it like to be a college president?
It is incredibly frustrating, and it's not unlike being the parent of a college-age student because, as I said earlier, you either countenance the violation of the law and look the other way. And the message you send to the young adults in your midst by doing that is, in the long run, subversive of respect for law in general, because all you're saying is, if there are certain laws you disagree with, it's perfectly okay to break them. Or you crack down, and we're often told, well, all you need to do is enforce the law more rigorously, and you can solve this problem.
Is one of the challenges you face possibly that there's a class issue here? You're dealing with kids, as you said, on college campuses and the problems of underage drinking there. People who are concerned about drunk driving in many cases are maybe dealing with blue-collar issues of kids going out to bars after work and drinking. They may not be as sympathetic to your on-campus problems because they want their drunk 18-year-old kids in pickups off the highway. Is that possibly what's going on here?
I'm not sure that it is. Underage drinking is worst in the state of North Dakota. That's not Ivy League America. I believe that this is every bit as much an issue for the infantrymen in the military, for the carpenter, for the mechanic, for the farmer, as it is for the college students. Those families are every bit as affected by this as the parents of college students.
Well, in fact, one of your supporters is Michael Haynes at the National Social Norms Research Center at Northern Illinois University. He says when people talk about underage drinking, they really are thinking high schoolers or kids who they really perceive as too young to drink. But when you remind them that there are 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are married, who have families, who are in the military, they feel those people deserve the right to choose to drink.
Tell the infantryman who's just returned from combat in Iraq that he can't have a beer when he gets home, and try explaining why that law is good for him and why a state that would substitute its judgment for his, the same state that says he's mature enough to carry a weapon and defend his country, to sit on a jury, to sign a contract, to do everything else that an adult is permitted to do, but that his brain's not fully enough developed, his maturity is not fully enough advanced for him to consume a beer. Mm-hmm. Try making that argument to that person with a straight face, plausibly. I'd really like to see it done. I couldn't do it.
Professor McArdle, one last question. What are students telling you? The Chronicle of Higher Education spoke to several. One had a roommate who had been hospitalized for alcohol poisoning, and he said lowering the drinking age would only cause more reckless drinking on campus. What are you hearing from kids?
What I'm hearing is that 18-year-olds are tired of being infantilized on this particular issue. They know perfectly well that the law in every other respect regards them as adults. They know that only four countries have a drinking age as high as 21, and the other three are Indonesia, Mongolia, and Palau. They go abroad, they travel, they see young adults acting like adults, and they wonder why they can't be trusted. And they're unwilling to accept patronizing explanations that talk about their lack of maturity and the inability of their brain to lead them to make wise decisions. If we really believe that, and if that were really so, we should raise the age majority to 21.
Well, we should point out that one of the other students the Chronicle spoke with was for lowering the drinking age. He said that that would allow for safety controls. It would allow for fraternities to appoint someone to be trained and handle alcohol-related emergencies because it was legal. It's legal, and they can make it up front.
We need to have laws that reflect the social realities, not laws that reflect some particular group or individual's idea of what constitutes perfection. And to the degree that our laws are reflective of balance and maturity and common sense, those laws will be effective.
John McArdle was president of Middlebury College in Middlebury, Vermont for 13 years. He now heads an organization called Choose Responsibility, trying to get the national drinking age lowered from 21 to 18. And Professor McArdle, you're president emeritus now, but you know, you could be doing a lot of different things, one of them perhaps relaxing in a nice leather chair. Why do you feel so passionately about this?
Me crosswise about this and say, my goodness, why, of all the things you might be doing, why did you choose this? Well, it's real simple. I wrote an op-ed article a couple of years ago right after I stepped down saying that there are certain things college presidents, for various reasons, are simply unable or unwilling to say while they're in office because they tend to be controversial and there are only so many issues you can take on at one time. I was very heartened by the response I got to that article. Many of those responses from college presidents saying, you know, you have it exactly right, and I support what you're doing. Now, it's awfully presumptuous to say that I'm taking this on behalf of all of my fellow or former college and university presidents. But I have to think, based on the response that I've gotten to date and by what I think is the willingness of the public to engage in this discussion, that this is a discussion worth having. These are serious issues. We're talking about the rising generation of leaders, and we're talking about whether infantilizing them and making a single exception out of them in this particular area is the best way to prepare them in the long run to conduct themselves as adults. If our laws breed disrespect for law in general, and if our attitudes infantilize, I don't think we're doing a very good job of preparing these leaders to assume those responsibilities. It's time to change that, and that's an important cause to take on.
Again, John McArdle, former president of Middlebury College. We first spoke with him in April. He says lowering the drinking age will save lives, and again, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, other groups oppose that thinking. Well, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, a college cult favorite, The History of the Modern World in Cartoons with Larry Gonick. And still ahead today, on the campaign trail with presidential hopeful John McCain. Back after the news, Here and Now. Republican presidential candidate John McCain, whose campaign has stumbled, apparently faced a tough crowd in an event at Concord High School in New Hampshire yesterday. A student asked the Arizona senator if he'd be able to govern, given that at 71, he'd be older than Reagan. In fact, McCain would be the oldest person ever to start a term in the Oval Office. Would he worry, the student asked, about dying in office or getting Alzheimer's? The senator used a little humor to deflect the question.
Every campaign I've ever been in my life, I've out-campaigned all of my opponents, and I'm confident that I will. Thanks for the question, you little jerk.
McCain then went on to say, and you're drafted. Well, humor might be hard to come by lately. Polls in the first primary state of New Hampshire show support for McCain down from 27% in April to 12% last month. He once was widely perceived as a favorite to win the Republican nomination. In a 2000 campaign, McCain was flying high in the big Straight Talk Express bus with plenty of campaign staff. Yesterday, when Here Now's Bob Oakes caught up with him on the road, McCain was trailed by a skeletal staff and a couple of vans. Their first topic, Iraq.
President Bush, when he was in Iraq this weekend, hinted he thinks a U.S. troop withdrawal might be possible in Iraq. What's your thinking along those lines? Do you believe a troop withdrawal is possible in the near future?
I don't know how near the future, but there's no doubt in my mind that the new strategy is succeeding, and there will be, I think, over coming months, could be redeployment of troops to, for example, up on the border and to other areas while we turn over more and more responsibilities to the Iraqi military. That's the whole object of the strategy.
Defense Secretary Gates said in the last few days that he's more optimistic about Iraq than any time since he took the job. Do you share that optimism?
Yes, we've had steady progress. There's areas that are still a long way from resolved. The Maliki government not acting effectively. But the political progress has taken place from the ground up, from the local side. But overall, the strategy, as I predicted, is succeeding where the other failed.
Will there ever be a perfect political situation in Baghdad?
No, I think if we look at our own history, nearly 100 years after we became a nation, we had to fight a bloody civil war to find out what kind of a nation we were going to be. So I think it'll be flawed, but I think it'll be functioning. I think the most difficult part is the rule of law. It's easy to have an election. The rule of law takes time, effort, and a lot of hard work in order to give people that part of democracy.
When President Bush recently compared the war in Iraq to Vietnam, he rekindled for many people the thought that the U.S. in Iraq is headed for a Vietnam-like quagmire. Is that a fair concern?
I think what the president was trying to say was that the consequences of an immediate failure would be a chaotic and genocidal situation. And I agree to the extent that I think that setting a date for withdrawal would lead to genocide and chaos in the country and eventually in the region.
Does our commitment in Iraq quite simply need to be open-ended?
If you mean open-ended commitment like we have to South Korea, that's fine with me. We've got troops in South Korea for more than 50 years. And everybody's fine with that, and we've been a stabilizing force in the region as well as Korea.
So a decades-long stabilizing force in Iraq would be all right with you if that's what it took to help stabilize the region?
No, because I don't think we can stay for an extended period of time in a Muslim country. But I do think an American presence and an advisory capacity, and maybe in some bases, is certainly a possibility. But do I see setting a timetable for withdrawal? No, that's a timetable for surrender.
Next week, the long-awaited report from General Petraeus will be delivered when the general testifies before Congress. Do you think he'll win much support from your fellow members up on Capitol Hill?
I don't know if he will or not, because a lot of people have already made up their minds. What I'm hopeful is that we can keep those who want to set a date for withdrawal from getting 60 votes so that we can give this successful strategy a chance to achieve more success.
Can public opinion be brought around? Can the American people be convinced to support this war again in the majority?
It depends on the facts on the ground, which are improving. The American people are frustrated and they're saddened and they're angered because of our failure and our sacrifices in Iraq. And I share that. And I want us out too. But I want us out the right way and for the right regions. And I understand why their patience is exhausted. And yet I would try to point out and make the argument that this strategy is succeeding, and we ought to give it more opportunity to do so.
Immigration. You voted yes on the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act of 2006, which would have created the guest worker program, and yes on the Secure Fence Act, which would have created the fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. We know that a temporary guest worker program is unpopular with many Republicans, so I'm wondering if you can thumbnail what your plan might be now following the failure of immigration reform in Congress.
Well, we failed because the American people lack any trust and confidence in our ability to do things on their behalf. When we said we would secure the border, they simply didn't believe us. As president, I would swear that we will secure the borders, and then we have to move forward with other aspects of the immigration issue.
How does it affect you that you're not the front runner in the polls the way you were just a few months ago?
Well, every campaign I've been in, there's been ups and downs, and I'm happy with the prospects of the debates that are coming up and with my positions, my ability to campaign in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Iowa in a most effective fashion. And so, of course, you always want to be leading by 50 points.
In your mind, how much has your support for the war cost you politically in this campaign?
I think it's cost me. I think that immigration has cost me. I think other mistakes that we may have made, those weren't mistakes, by the way, but other things that have happened have cost me. But I believe at the end of the day that the reason why I win is because people may not agree with me on a specific issue, but they will have confidence that I will always do what I believe is the right thing.
The straight-talking McCain is always the straight-talking McCain?
Yeah.
Senator John McCain, very good to see you again. Thanks a lot for letting us tag along with you today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again. Thanks.
Here now is Bob Oakes speaking with Republican presidential hopeful John McCain on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. McCain will be one of 8 GOP presidential candidates taking part in a televised debate in that state tonight. And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live at our website, here-now.org, or for past programs, you can click on the archives, and you can download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go. Before we go today, the new HBO drama, Tell Me You Love Me, it premieres this Sunday. Our critic has commitment issues, with the show that is. You'll hear that. You're listening to Here and Now. If you were to venture into space today, chances are you would soon need to spend some time outside your spaceship. And to do so, you would have to wear more than 300 pounds of space suit and various gear, all necessary to create the right conditions for an astronaut to survive. Those bulky suits might not be a huge problem in the vastness of space, where the lack of gravity makes the weight and bulk manageable. But conditions on the surface of other planets or the moon might cause, well, a wardrobe malfunction. Now an MIT professor hopes she's found a way around the problem of a bulky spacesuit with a skin-tight model that offers the same protection. Here now's Chris Cuff went to find out more.
I was strolling on the moon one day in a merry, merry month of December. May.
That's astronaut Jack Schmidt, taking a stroll during the last mission to the moon in December 1972. He was wearing a spacesuit that's not much different from the ones used today. Weighing more than 300 pounds and pressurized with gases to recreate the atmosphere we feel on Earth. It's sort of like being inside a giant balloon. Astronauts need suits that create pressure, because without it, their blood would literally boil and use up all of the body's oxygen in about 15 seconds. NASA has used the gas pressure model since the early days of space travel. But now they want a leaner, sleeker spacesuit for the 21st century. More Stan Lee's Spider-Man than John Glenn's Right Stuff.
That's where our biosuit design comes in.
That's Dr. David Newman of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's worked with NASA for 20 years and is designing the new suit. It looks like skin-tight white spandex, covered in black and gold ridges that follow the contours of the body, with red highlights around the arms and neck. The material feels soft, but it's dense, like thickly woven gauze, and creates pressure without relying on gases. Again, Dr. Newman.
It's another approach. Instead of a gas-pressurized shell, you have to apply pressure to keep someone alive. Well, another way you can do it, rather than a bubble or a balloon, is to apply it directly on the skin. That's why mechanical counterpressure, we're literally applying the pressure to the skin through the suit. So now you have a second skin garment, and it's a much less massive, much less heavy. We can build in maximum mobility.
Mobility astronauts need in space. Just ask astronaut Jack Schmidt.
No, dadgummit.
Jack Schmidt having a few problems.
That was Schmidt falling face first into the moon while bending over to scoop up a sample bag. It seemed to be a common problem, with astronauts often falling or dropping equipment.
Remind me to dust my camera, too, will you? Don't forget to dust your camera.
We'll keep track of that for you, see?
Did you get any before pictures? I'm getting them now. Okay.
So part of the research at MIT is to study the way people move in a low-gravity environment. The scientists built a giant arch, attached a rope and harness to it, and hook up test subjects, who try to move while dangling in midair. Doctoral candidate Leah Sterling tells us what they can learn from those tests.
So normally when people move around, they rotate by creating a torque against the floor, against an object. If you're sitting in a chair, you sometimes push against a desk. In space, what we have is this ability to rotate without using external torques, and I call that self-rotation. One of the things, though, is that people don't really, they're not familiar with self-rotation. So the key is, can people do this? Is it really easy? Are some axes easier to rotate about than others?
The new suit will make it easier to maneuver and could eliminate some of the dangers of space exploration. For example, thousands of tiny pieces of debris, called micrometeors, are constantly whizzing through space like miniature bullets. If one of those pierces a traditional suit, gases seep out, and astronauts have to return to their ship immediately for a patch job. Dr. Newman says a nick in her suit wouldn't matter, because there are no gases inside to leak out.
So if you're in a gas-pressurized shell and you had a tear or a micrometeorite hit, it would be a major, major emergency. You'd have to get to a safe haven right away, be on emergency oxygen. I mean, that's end of the spacewalk.
This new suit should be ready in about 10 years. And with input from an Italian design firm, you can bet these suits will be on the cutting edge of style as well as science.
Here now is Chris Cuff at MIT. For more on the spacesuits of the future, go to our website, here-now.org. Coming up, our critic at large has a preview of Tell Me You Love Me, the new HBO drama pushing the envelope on sex and nudity. If you have little ones with you, this might be a time to pop in that Raffi tape. Back after a quick break, here and now. Mm-hmm. From The Sopranos and 6 Feet Under to Ali G and Big Love, Monday morning water cooler discussions are often dominated by what people saw on HBO the night before. Well, this Sunday comes HBO's latest offering, Tell Me You Love Me, a drama about three couples and their adventures or misadventures in the bedroom and in their therapist's office. And the water cooler talk is about to get very graphic because this show has just about the most graphic sex scenes you've ever seen on TV. So our conversation about the show may be a little too graphic for some as well, we should say. But we're going to start with critic at large Ed Siegel. Ed, welcome.
Nice to see you, Robin.
And I'm thinking there might have to be a separate R-rated section of the water cooler for conversation about this show. Did you love it?
No, I can't say that I loved it, but I really respected it in the morning.
Oh, no. Is it going to be one of those puns galore about the show because it's difficult to talk about it? But tell us more. I mean, did you really respect it in the morning?
Yeah, I did. You know, there used to be these X-rated movies where it would start with a wizened old actor who was playing a therapist, and he'd be talking in a very clinical way, and then they'd switch to the hardcore sex. Tell Me You Love Me reverses that ploy. Here we have the hardcore sex, and the purpose of it seems to be to get us drawn into the therapy sessions.
Now, when you say that, I've seen an hour on DVD. How can you communicate to people how much they're actually going to see?
Well, every body part gets pretty much equal time on the show, and it's not done in the kind of romanticized way that we've been accustomed to. It's done in an almost documentary style. The whole show is done in a kind of documentary style.
But like those films you described, there is a therapist. Tell us about that.
The therapist is played by Jane Alexander, who is one of the more sympathetic characters on the show. And she's actually, we see her private life as well. Her husband is played by David Selby, who you might remember from TV shows like Dark Shadows. Here's an excerpt with Jane Alexander talking to a couple who can't conceive. And as she's talking to them, they're flashing back to what really happened, which is not exactly the way they're expressing it to her.
Do you resent the pressure you must feel now? When you're having sex?
No.
No, not at all.
It's tough, you know, to just become this sperm machine. I exist,
you know,
and I'm...
Don't give me your feminine side right now. I mean, I love that about you, but not right now. Right now, I just want you to fuck me, so.
No.
What?
I can't. I'm too removed.
No.
Mm-mm.
Okay, two familiar themes. Deceit, you know, maybe even with themselves, and a therapist. We had Lorraine Bracco's Dr. Melfi on The Sopranos. Tell us about the rest of the cast, the characters they play.
Well, we have Ali Walker and Tim DeKay as a couple with great kids, but they can't find a way to have sex together. Sonia Walker and Adam Scott, a Tom Cruise lookalike, they have great sex, but they can't find a way to have kids together. They're the ones we heard with Alexander. And this is Michelle Borth. She plays a young, beautiful woman with issues about sex and relationships, and she's talking here with her fiancé about fidelity.
Do you think I'm the only guy you're ever going to want for the rest of your life, ever?
We're not talking about me.
Well, I just think we could start our marriage with being honest.
Yeah, well, I don't think I want to start a marriage with someone who's telling me he's going to cheat on me.
That's not what I'm saying.
Yes, it is.
No.
Yeah, it is. No, you're not saying it, but that's what you're saying. Well, this is f***ed up. Why didn't you tell me this before now? I mean, we've talked about everything, right? We've talked about our kids, our future, who we want to be, what kind of f***ing pots and pans we want to buy, but you don't tell me that you don't plan to be monogamous?
So we're really getting the sense that this isn't going to be, oh, something that maybe the whole family will want to gather around on a Sunday evening. Tell us more.
No, even the most liberal parents that I know who didn't think twice about watching other HBO shows with their kids, I don't think that they're going to watch this together. And my guess is that some of the most discomforting scenes of the show will be the masturbation scenes.
Boy, I'm thinking, what a difference a time slot makes. You know, because when this topic was, you know, on Seinfeld, the Masters of Their Domain episode, it's pretty funny. But
here, very little is played for laughs,
right,
Robin.
Right.
Everything, including the sex, is done in this very grim, claustrophobic way as producer Cynthia Mort tries to show the trials and tribulations of making monogamy work in a world that doesn't put a whole lot of value on that.
Well, grim is a word that's been used to describe this show, which doesn't, you know, you'd think, oh, sexy, fun, but it's not fun. And in fact, there's some anger.
There is. And here's an example. This is Decay is the guy who can only dance with himself, to quote Billy Idol, giving the therapist and his wife a piece of his mind in the first session.
You know what? I should be in the mood every time I clean out the gecko cage. Everybody else is, it seems. You know what else turns me on? I'll tell you what turns me on. Buying Cheerios is really hot. And then, of course, going and getting shoelaces or fantasizing about minivans. That's sexy, too. I really want to do that. It's excellent foreplay. Or, you know what else is good foreplay? When you are comparing apple juice prices and they both don't even want to be in the grocery store, but you know you got to get back because they got to be fed before they go to bed. And then at bed, all you're doing is just reading to them, probably and telling them the same damn story for the 100th time. Then, after all that, then I am ready to have sex, because all that is so hot.
Our entire life. That's what you just trashed. Our entire life.
And of course, you could hear that scene with the roles reversed, you know. I'm sure. So your thoughts?
Well, you know, I thought that was one of the most dramatic scenes that I've come across in the first five or six episodes, but scenes like that are a little too few and far between. Mostly, there are a lot of pregnant pauses and inarticulate speeches of the heart and other body parts.
Well, and some would say, you know, the pauses and everything, that's what therapy is, you know. So what do you think of the show, dramatically?
Well, you know, I hated the show 30-something for all its self-absorption and the lack of what I think of as real drama. And I think that this show is guilty of some of the same problems. But I do find myself fascinated with it. Even though the therapeutic parts can be deadly earnest, the issues that they talk about are real and often swept under the rug in most TV shows and in a lot of marriages as well.
And how about the sex part? We keep coming back to that. Are they going to be able to keep up the pace, at least of the first hour?
You know, Robin, I used to watch the Beatles movies. I'd be curious about how director Richard Lester was going to work the songs into the story. And here I'm kind of curious about this in the same way. How are they going to work the graphic sex scene into this week's episode?
And we should say that it's not just, you know, young couples that are having that sex.
Well, for the most part, it is. But Jane Alexander and David Selby do get into the act. And, you know, people might be shocked to see the former chairwoman of the NEA going at it like this. But that'll be another one of those things that will either turn people on or switching the station.
Actually, some people who are critics of the NEA under her rule may not be surprised.
Right. They'll say this is what happens when we get people like this on the NEA.
Well, what people won't do for their art. Here and now, critic at large Ed Siegel talking to us about HBO's new series, Tell Me You Love Me, which begins this Sunday at 9 Eastern time. Ed, thank you so much for joining us and for keeping those sexual puns to a minimum.
And, you know, now I can't think of anything that doesn't have a double meaning, so I'll just say thank you, Robin.
What do you mean by that? Take care.
Bye-bye.
My love for you will never die, even though sometimes it makes me cry. So tell me that you love me, wouldn't put no one above me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
My love is real, and it's so, so strong. I'll be loving you from now on. So tell me that you love me, wouldn't put no one above me, oh, me.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.